Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's my pleasure to introduce Richard Stallman, actually, because of the fact that he needs no introductions. Myself being an Emacs user for a number of years, and a GNU Linux user for even almost as many years as that, I can appreciate the many contributions that he has brought to us. And more than that, I believe he's here for not only for his many accomplishments and for the fact that he started the Free Software Foundation, not just what he accomplished, but what actually stands for. And the idea that you have to do and have to work out towards your community. It's an important fact that should never be or can never be too much stressed. And without further ado, I give the word to Richard Stallman. You're all welcome to him, please.
About a software development project, but this is not a technical talk. This is not a technical subject. The issue is ethical and social. The issue is, what should the rules of society be for using software? Most of the time when people raise that question, they work for software companies. And they raise it in a self-serving direction. They ask, what rules can we impose on everyone else to make them pay us a lot of money? I'm sure you are familiar with the answers that they propose. I had the good fortune in the 70s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. And from that experience, I was led to look at this question from a different direction, to ask, what rules make for a good society that's good to live in? And so I reached completely different answers. Let me tell you a little bit about this community. It included programmers at some of the best universities, and programmers at computer companies also sometimes participated. The lab where I worked, the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, was in a way the deepest part of this community. Because there, all the software we used was the community software. We had an entire operating system, the incompatible time-sharing system, or ITS for short, which was developed entirely by the hackers, the programmers in our community. And the team that developed that system was the team that I joined when I was hired by the lab to be a system hacker. Back in 1971. And so we were living a way of life that involved cooperating with people. When you walk past another hacker's screen and you saw something interesting, you'd say, hey, what is that? And he would tell you, oh, that's a new FUBAR program that we just got from Stanford, and it's in the FUBAR directory. So in that directory, you would see the executable that you could run, and also the source code, which you could read and study to see how they solve those problems. In using the program, you probably run into bugs, and you might have ideas for new features. So you could go to the source code and fix the bugs or add new features. You could even cut out a piece of it to put it into some other program that you were writing. We call that cannibalizing the old program, which was a joke, because when you cannibalize a machine for spare parts, it destroys that machine, it doesn't work anymore. But when you cannibalize a program in this way, the old program keeps working just fine because you're actually making a copy of part of the code. So you could use this program in all the various ways it could potentially be useful. You were not limited to just treating it as a black box, using it in ignorance. The software that we developed was part of human knowledge. That was our purpose. We were working in a science lab, and you were developing human knowledge for humanity to use. And because of this, I was able to feel very good about the work I was doing. I was not merely helping one group of people to feed another group of people. I was working for all humanity. But later, we got a taste of what life was like for most computer users, the ones who were not part of a cooperating community like that one. That happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. Now, that was a very handsome gift in some ways. It was the first time anyone outside Xerox had a laser printer. The machine was actually the first generation laser printer. Is it big? Too much. That's better. Okay. It was actually a high-speed office copier that had been modified to turn it into a printer. Now, in some ways, the machine worked very well. It printed a page a second. It had high resolution, and straight lines came out nice and straight. But it also had a problem. It got paper jams frequently. Now, as a printer, that might not have mattered. There would have been somebody nearby to fix the jam. Sorry, as a copy, that wouldn't have mattered much. But as a printer, it was off by itself somewhere, and sometimes a long time would go by with nobody passing by there, and it would stay jammed for a long time. Now, when we gradually recognized that this was a problem, we immediately thought of a way to solve it. Because that is the same method we had used for our old printer. The old printer was slow and low resolution and tended to make straight lines a little bit wavy. And in addition, frequently got paper jams or ran out or something. So because we were programmers, not printer engineers, we couldn't make the printer itself better. Instead, we added features to the software that ran the printer to compensate for the problems. For instance, every time the printer finished a print job, the system would display a message on the screen of the user who printed it, saying, "Your file food has been printed." So you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra just because you didn't know when it was time to collect the output. And there was another feature that I remember adding. Every time the printer got in trouble, the system displayed a message for all of the users currently waiting for printing, saying, "The printer is in trouble, go fix it." So, if you got that message, you would not take the risk of assuming someone else would obey, because you knew there were only a few people waiting to printer. So you would go immediately to the printer. Therefore, the printer still got in trouble, but a minute later, two or three people would arrive, and at least one would know how to fix it and would teach the rest. In effect, we treated the user as part of the system and added end-to-end feedback, and so we obtained reliable operation for the entire system, even though the printer component was still unreliable. That was well and good. So, of course, we thought of trying to solve the problem for the new printer in the same way. But then we ran into a stone wall. You see, we were able to make these changes in these features for the old printer because it was controlled by the community software, free software. We had the source code, and we could make changes limited only by our skill. But the new printer was controlled by a proprietary Xerox program. We did not have the source code, and that meant we were helpless. We were, in effect, prisoners of our software. And the result was constant frustration. You would type the command to print a file and then go back to work, but it's no use looking for the output soon. A while later, you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. Probably not long enough. not worth going. So you go back to work, and a while later you notice the time. Now it's been an hour, maybe it's printed. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it's been jammed the whole time. So you fix it and go back to work, and a while later you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour, maybe it's printed now. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was 3.5 minutes of printing for that fast printer, and then jammed again. And at that point, you say, I'm going to stand here and fix this every time it jams until I get my outcome. It wasn't supposed to work that way, but it did. And it was all the more frustrating to realize that we could have solved the problem, but somebody in Xerox was deliberately standing in our way, deliberately keeping us focused. Then I heard somebody at Carnegie Mellon University had a copy of that source code. So eventually I was visiting there, so I went to his office and said, hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer software source code? And he said, no, I promise not to give you a copy. And I was stunned as well as angry. I couldn't think of a way to do justice to the anger. All I could think of was to walk out of the room without saying one more word to it. But I kept thinking about it afterwards. His refusal to cooperate with us, his colleagues at MIT, was very bad for us because we never got that source code and we were never able to solve this problem. And the printer remained painful to use for all the years we kept using it. But at the same time, it was very good for me indirectly because it taught me an important lesson, a lesson that's important especially because most programmers don't learn it. You see, he had promised to refuse to help us, his colleagues at MIT, if we ever needed his help. But he didn't just do that to us. Chances are he did the same thing to you. And most likely, he did it to you too. And I expect he did it to you as well. In fact, he probably did it to a lot of you in this room. The exceptions being those of you who weren't born yet, because that was 1980 or so. Because he had promised to refuse his cooperation to just about the entire population of planet Earth. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first direct encounter with the non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They're not innocent. They're not harmless. You're really hurting someone, except you don't know who. It's like signing a blank check of betrayal. I promise I will not cooperate with blank. And the blank gets filled in later by circumstances. Perhaps with the name of a stranger, perhaps with the name of your brother. Most programmers first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some kind of goodie, some temptation that they'll get if they sign. So they make up excuses to close their eyes to the ethics of what they're doing. They say to themselves, they'll never get copies anyway, so what difference does it make if I join a conspiracy to deprive them? They say, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to go against this? They say, if I don't sign this, someone else will. There are different excuses to gag their consciences. But when I was invited to sign a non-disclosure agreement, my conscience had already been sensitized. It was aware. I couldn't forget how angry I had been when somebody else had done this to me. And I couldn't turn somebody else who didn't deserve it any more than I did. So I said, thank you for offering me this nice software, but I cannot accept it on these conditions, so I'll do without it. No thank you. And thus I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, such as software. Now, there are other kinds of information which raise different issues. For instance, there is personal information, completely different question. I think it's reasonable to keep personal information private for people. For instance, if you asked if we could talk about what was happening between you and your sweetheart, and I please not tell anybody, that I could agree to, because that's not generally useful technical information. At least probably. Now, I could imagine that you might disclose to me some wonderful new sex technique that you two have developed, and then I would feel a moral obligation to pass this on to other people who might perhaps have a chance to use it. But if you just want to talk to me about telenovela stuff, who hurt whose feelings, how, and what that one didn't know, and what that one, someone else did in response, and all those things, those details of your life are not something other people need to know in order to live their lives well. They have their own soap operas. So that sort of thing, I could agree to keep private. But when it comes to the stuff of science and technology, the mission of these fields is to develop useful information for humanity to use. If we withhold it instead, we are betraying the mission of our field. And this, after some years of thought, I concluded was wrong and nobody should ever do it. But at the same time, during the same period, a series of blows fell on my community and wiped it out. The last blow, perhaps, was when Digital discontinued making the PDP-10 computer. Now, this was serious for us because the incompatible time-sharing system was started in the 60s and it was written in assembler language for the PDP-10. So when the PDP-10 was discontinued, 15 years of our work turned into dust and blew away. Now that is a heavy blow for anyone. But the consequences were even worse, because it meant I could not keep working in my field as I had been doing it. That depended on having a community to work with and a body of free software to work on and use. Both of them were gone. So what was I going to do? The most obvious possibility was to accept that the world had changed and adapt myself to it. To start using non-free software, signing non-disclosure agreements. And I expect MIT would have had me developing non-free software too, because it had already done such things. I thought about that and realized that way I could have fun programming and I could make money. But in the end, I look back and say, I spent my career building walls to divide people. And I would be ashamed of all I've done. So I looked for another possibility, and it was easy to find one. I could leave the computer field and do something else. Most programmers regard this as unthinkable. They say, if I don't do this, this, and this so I can get a programming job, I'll starve. That's literally the word they use. But it's nonsense. You know, even in the US, there are millions of people who work in areas other than programming, and they don't starve. Now, I had no other noteworthy skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not in a fine restaurant, I suppose. But I could have been a waiter somewhere. Now, there are two things about being a waiter. One is, as a waiter, you're not doing anything unethical unless you're working at McDonald's. And the other is, as a waiter, you're not going to starve unless you're working at McDonald's. Now, people should be aware that the success of McDonald's was due to a misunderstanding of Americans who hadn't studied English well enough. They heard the term fast food and they thought it meant rapid food. Actually, fast there doesn't mean rapid, it refers to not eating. Fast food was never meant to be eaten. The purpose of that food is that if you are fasting, and if you're getting hungry and you're feeling tempted to eat, you think about that McDonald's food and you lose your appetite. And that way you can complete your fast. So don't make the mistake of the poorly educated. Don't ever eat the McDonald's food. I have found an ethical way to cope with my situation, and that makes an important difference, because sometimes you can justify doing something unethical if the consequence of not doing it is that you lose a job. But I wouldn't die, I would just have to be a waiter. I have found an ethical way to cope with the situation, meaning that I couldn't make that excuse. However, I realize that being a waiter for me would be no fun at all. And it would be a waste of my skill as an operating system developer. Now, it's better to waste your skills than to misuse them. To develop non-free software, please turn off your cell phones if you have any. I hope you don't have them. They are tracking devices. If you carry a cell phone, you're carrying a tracking device so that the government can make a record of where you have been all the time and keep it permanently. And if they ever think that you're a dissident, then they can find out who else you've been talking to and so on. So don't use cell phones. Develop non-free software is misuse of your skill. That's actually harming the world. To waste your skill is not harming the world, but it's still unfortunate. So I decided to look for some other possibility. I asked myself, what could an operating system developer do in this situation that would be positive, that would make the world a better place? And I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what was needed. The moral dilemma existed for me and for anyone using computers because all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. You had to sign a non-disclosure agreement just to get the binary so you could run your computer. So if an operating system developer were to write another operating system and make it free software and encourage people to use it freely and cooperate, this would give everybody a way out of the dilemma, a way to use computers in freedom in an upright way. I realized that this was the most important thing I would ever have a chance to do in my life, probably. And I concluded I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. It's like when you come across somebody who's drowning, and it's not Bush, then you must try. Well, maybe that's not quite true. There might be a few others you can say. And no one else was going to try to solve it if I did not. So I decided I would develop a free software operating system or die trying, presumably of old age, because at the time, the free software movements had no enemies. Nobody was trying to stop us from developing a free operating system. The only obstacle was simply a lot of work, a lot of software to be written. That decision led to other decisions, technical design decisions. What kind of system should it be? Well, I had just seen one free operating system turn into dust and go away because it was written in assembler language for one kind of computer, which then was discontinued. I didn't want that to happen again. Clearly, this system had better be portable. There was just one portable operating system that was a success, as far as I knew, and that was Unix. In addition, Unix had some good ideas compared with various other systems of the day, such as pipes and redirection of input and output, shell programming that was fairly powerful, the fork and exec system calls that were convenient enough people really used them. So I decided to follow the design of Unix, figuring that would give me a good chance of developing a system that really would work and really would be portable. In addition, I realized that users don't like incompatible changes, and there were many Unix users already. If I had taken the best ideas I knew of from the various systems I worked with, plus my own ideas, I could have designed my dream operating system. But then I knew the users would have said, this is very nice, but it's incompatible. We've written our software for Unix. We've taught our users to use Unix. It would be too much work to switch. So I realized that that would be a big obstacle to the use of whatever system I would develop. Now, I could have had an excuse then. I could have said, I offered them liberty and they refused it, now it's their fault. But I wanted to do more than just make an excuse for failure. I wanted to create a community which would have people living in it, living in freedom and cooperation. So to do that, I had to develop a system people would actually use. I decided to make the system upward compatible with Unix. Upward compatible meaning that we could add more features, whatever we could think of, but the ways of doing things that worked on Unix had to keep working on our system. This, in effect, made almost all the initial design decisions, because Unix consists of many components that communicate through interfaces that are more or less documented. So to be compatible with Unix, you have to replace each component compatible. The remaining design decisions were within one component, so they could be made later by whoever wrote that component. They didn't have to be made at the outset. But there was one other decision to make at the outset, which was what range of computers should it support? And then I did something I rarely do. I made a prediction about the direction of technology. I figured it would take years to develop an entire operating system, and by that time, people would all be using 32-bit computers. Unix was designed to run on 16-bit machines, and that's a lot of extra work. You have to break up large programs into small passes. You have to read in a bit of the data and operate on it and write it out and so on. Whereas with a big address space, you can read everything into memory and just do your work. So it's a lot easier. So I decided we would not support 16-bit machines. And indeed, that's what happened. By the time we had a complete system, everyone was getting 32-bit machines. So the decisions were made. All we needed to start work was a name. We hackers are people who like the spirit of playful cleverness. That's what it means to be a hacker. And when we write software, we tend to look for funny or even mischievous names, because thinking of the users being amused used by the name is half the fun of running the program. And we had a hacker tradition that when you are writing a program that's similar to an existing program, something we had to do pretty often in the days before programs were portable, you could give the new program a name, which was a recursive acronym, which said that this program is not the other program. For instance, in the 60s and 70s, there were many text editors fairly similar, called TICO. Each one was something or other TICO. But one clever programmer called his program TINT, for TINT is not TICO, the first recursive acronym. We thought this was tremendously funny, so we looked for other chances to make recursive acronyms too. In 1975, I developed the first Emacs editor, the extensible programmable text editor. And there were many imitations, some called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And Aina, for Aina is not Emacs. And Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. Aina was mostly rewritten, and version 2 was called Zwei, for Zwei was Aina initially. So I looked for a recursive acronym name for something that is not Unix. But I tried the standard four-letter approach, and the problem is none of them was a word, at least not in the language I knew. So the result, if it doesn't have a second meaning, it's not funny. So I tried another method. I tried making a contraction to get a three-letter recursive acronym. I started substituting letters, ANU, GNU, 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 GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language. People were asking each other, hey, what's GNU, long before there was a GNU system, or before it was even thought of. But now there's a new answer. You can answer GNU's not Unix. And it has the virtue that it sounds like you are obnoxiously telling the person what it isn't instead of what it is. But in fact, you're telling the person exactly what it is. Now, why do people ask each other what's GNU and make other jokes about the word GNU? The reason is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced GNU. And this silent G just strikes people as funny. But when it's the name of our system, please ignore the dictionary and pronounce a hard G. Pronounce it GNU. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. Because we've been working on it for almost 20 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So, we had a name, we could start work. In September 83, I posted an announcement on net. And January 84, I quit my job at MIT to start writing these pieces of the GNU system. I had to quit my job because if I kept working at MIT, MIT could have claimed to own the software and could have turned it into proprietary software products. And that would have completely defeated the purpose of writing it. I'd rather not have written it at all than see that happen. And rather than have to negotiate with MIT about this, I took MIT out of the equation by quitting my job. However, the head of the AI lab was nice enough to let me keep using the facilities, so I began using a Unix machine at MIT to write pieces of GNU. That was my first actual use of Unix. I was never a Unix wizard, as some other people were. I chose to imitate Unix for the precise reasons I told you. Fortunately, when I got to see what Unix was like up close, I saw a few flaws, but nothing disastrous. So I decided the plan to imitate Unix was still a good idea. time, I believe we would write all these programs, put them together and have a complete system, and then people would begin to use it. But that's not what happened. In September 84, I started writing GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of the extensible programmable text editor. And in early 85, it was working well enough that I could use it for all my editing, which was a big convenience, because I had no intention of using VI. So until that time, I did my editing on some other computer and copied the files through the net in order to test them on the Unix machine. But once GNU Emacs was running, I could do my editing on the Unix machine. But when GNU Emacs was working well enough for my editing, it was good enough for other people's editing too. People wanted a copy. And so I had to work out the details of how to distribute these pieces of GNU, these GNU programs, as we call them. And so I put a copy in the FTP server directory. That enabled people on the net to get copies. But in 1985, most programmers were not on the internet, and they were asking me for copies anyway, so I had to decide what I would tell them. I could have said, I want to spend my time writing more pieces of the GNU system, not writing magnetic tapes. So find a friend who's on the internet who will download it and put it on tape for you. And they would have got copies sooner or later. But I had no job. In fact, I've never had a job since then. So I was looking for some way I could make money through my work on free software. Therefore, I announced, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of GNU Emacs. And the orders began dribbling in. By the middle of the year, they were trickling in. I was getting 8 to 10 orders a month, which, if necessary, I could have lived on, because I've always deliberately made a point of living cheaply, basically the same way I did as a student. I don't like getting in the habit of spending money. Now, this is very different from most Americans. When they make this much money, they look for a way to spend this much. So they start buying houses and cars and boats and airplanes and rare stamps and artwork and adventure travel and children. All sorts of expensive luxuries. And then they have to desperately spend all their time trying to make the money to pay for these luxuries, so they have no time to play with them, which is especially sad for the children. It means they become puppets of whoever has money. Whereas if you resist these expensive habits, then you can decide what you're going to do with your life. You can do what you feel is important instead of what somebody else wants you to do. But some people used to ask me, what do you mean it's free software that costs $150? This is because they were led astray by the ambiguity of the English word free. It has multiple meanings. One refers to price, and another refers to freedom. When I speak of free software, I'm referring to freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. It's clearer in Portuguese. So when you're talking about free software and speaking Portuguese, never use the English word free. Always say livre. And so for some of those users, some got their copies of GNU Emacs from me through the net, and they did not pay. Others got their copies from me on a tape, and they did pay. Others got their copies from some other user who already had a copy. Maybe they paid that other user, but they didn't pay me. So GNU Emacs was gratis for some users, and it was paid for other users, but it was free software for all give the definition of free software. We define free software in terms of the user's freedom. There are certain freedoms you must have. This is always necessary. It's very easy to say, I believe in freedom. But unless you say what the freedom is, you are not really getting to the difficult issues. After all, potential freedoms conflict. So the real political issue is, which are the important freedoms that we should preserve for everyone, and which are the less important ones that have to give way so that we can preserve the important ones. So, here is the definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following freedoms, all of them. Freedom 0 is the freedom to run the program for any purpose in any manner. Freedom 1 is the freedom to help yourself by studying the source code so you can see what the program really does, and then changing it to suit your needs. Freedom 2 is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies to others. And freedom 3 is the freedom to help your community by publishing an improved version so others can benefit from your contribution. All of these freedoms are essential, and let me now explain why. Freedom 0 is pretty obvious. If you're not even free to run the program as you see fit for whatever job you're doing, then you're not free, obviously. And in fact, most software gives you that much freedom. There are exceptions, but they're obviously quite restricted programs. So the difference between free software and most software is in freedoms 1, 2, and 3. Freedom 2 is necessary so that people can cooperate with each other, so that they can treat each other in an upright way. For beings that can think and learn, share useful knowledge is a fundamental act of friendship. When these beings use computers, this act takes the form of sharing software. To forbid people to share with their neighbors is to set up a society of division, of isolation, alienation. And it attacks the spirit of goodwill, the willingness to help your neighbor, which is the most important resource of any society. This has been widely recognized. No society has too much of this spirit of goodwill. And the world's major religions have been actively trying to promote it for thousands of years. But now we see active efforts to poison this fundamental resource. When major social institutions say that it's wrong to share with your neighbor, what does that mean? When they call it piracy, what does that mean? It means they're saying that helping your neighbor is the ethical equivalent of attacking a ship, which is morality turned upside down, because attacking a ship is very bad, and helping your neighbor is good and should be encouraged. They even go so far as to punish people, threaten to imprison people for sharing with their neighbors. In the UK, a member of parliament proposed a 10-year prison sentence just for sharing with your neighbor. In the US, the maximum prison sentence is just a few years. In Argentina, their equivalent of a business software alliance sent letters to a lot of people threatening them with being raped in prison for using non-free software, for using unauthorized copies of non-free software, for sharing with their neighbors, essentially. The only word for this is terror campaign. And if you don't want your society to be filled with fear, the thing to do is to get rid of this practice of using non-free software. and get rid of the practice of threatening people who share. So freedom too is necessary so that we can live an upright life without fear. Freedom one is necessary so that we can control the software we use. With freedom one, you can study the code, see what the program does, and make it do what you want. So you have control over what your computer does. Without this freedom, you don't have control. The software developer, the owner, has control over what your computer does. If there's a bug, even, you're helpless. But the problem is not limited to the accidental mistakes of the developer, because they put in malicious features as well. Features designed to spy on you, control you, interfere with you, or restrict you. And they often figure you won't even find out about them. For instance, Microsoft several years ago made a version of Windows send back to Microsoft a list of the files on the disk. There was a scandal about this. So they took it out, temporarily. This year, people discovered that Windows XP was in fact transmitting to Microsoft a list of what was on your disk, encrypted, so that it was hard for people to tell. It's not just operating systems that do this. Windows Media Player reports to Microsoft what you watch or listen to. And Microsoft is not the only guilty party, because RealPlayer does the same thing. These malicious features do other jobs as well. The Kazaa music sharing software actually makes you a part of a distributed computing scheme where they sell time on your computer. And when this was discovered, because they didn't tell people, they said, look at our software license. It permits us to do anything we want, including this. Windows automatically checks for an upgrade frequently. And that upgrade could be designed for you. It could be designed to shut off your machine. There's nothing you can do. You're helpless. So freedom one is necessary so that you can be in control of your own computer. But it's not really sufficient. It's the level of control it gives to society is insufficient. Because with just freedom one, only programmers could use this. And even for a programmer, the number of programs we could personally study and then learn how to change is limited. So we would have only a very limited amount of control, and non-programmers would not benefit at all. Therefore, freedom three is essential. Freedom three, the freedom to publish an improved version so that others can benefit from your contribution, is what gives society as a whole, users in whatever group they choose to make, control over their software. Imagine that there are 1 million people using a certain program, and that they want certain changes. Generally, they want certain changes. Well, maybe 10,000 of them are programmers, and of those 10,000, maybe 10 will decide to do this work. And once they have done it, everybody, including the non-programmers, gets to use the change. This is what enables the users collectively to take control of the software that they use. So free software means that the users are in control, both collectively and individually at the same time. Collectively, groups of users, whichever users choose to make changes, get the changes they want. So if a lot of people want changes in that direction, changes will be made quickly in that direction. There will be a lot of development there. If only a few want changes in that direction, then the program will make progress slowly in that direction. And if nobody wants changes in that direction, it won't change. But at the same time, you, if you want, can control what your copy does. You don't have to you don't have to be limited to what other people want. You can make it to what you want for you. Also, Freedom 3 makes it possible for non-programmers to pay programmers to make the changes they want. And this is very useful for businesses that use free software. It means that the business can control its own computing, make the computers do the job it wants to do. And this is also how free software business commonly works. And one of the consequences of this is that free software brings with it a free market for support and services of all kinds. This contrasts with non-free proprietary software, where support is normally a monopoly, because only the company that owns the program can actually change it. This is why the support for non-free software is usually so bad. And even if there's a choice of non-free programs to do a certain job, paradoxically, this is a choice between monopolies. Because once you choose a program, the support for it is going to be a monopoly. So this is a choice of masters, which is not the equivalent of freedom. But with free software, anyone can learn to offer support. And therefore, you're dealing with a free market. And if you value good support and you're willing to pay for it, you can generally get better support for your money in a world of free software. So instead of desperately having to try to get a chance to sue someone if the software doesn't work, a business can do what it does if it wants to change its building, right? Or if a wall breaks, you know, find a carpenter and pay him to fix it. You don't have to worry about whether you can sue the company that originally built the building. You just fix it. So free software is important both for practical reasons and for ethical reasons. It's the only way that we can live in freedom while using computers. And it enables us to defend various other freedoms as well in a world where we use computers. You might wonder why I defined this in the complicated way I did, said, defining what it means for a program to be free for a particular user. The reason is that sometimes the same code can be free for some users and non-free for the rest. Let me explain this with an example, the X window system. It was developed at MIT in the 80s and released under a license that gave you all these freedoms. So if you got the MIT version, it was free software for you. But among those who got this version were various computer companies that distributed Unix systems. They took the source code of X, they made changes to get it to run on their platform, they compiled it to make binaries, and they put those into their Unix system and distributed the binaries of X, of the X window system, under the same non-disclosure agreement as the other Unix binaries. Millions of users got those binaries of X, and they had none of these freedoms. So if you ask the question, is the X window system free software or not, the answer depended on how you measured. If you made the measurement coming out of the development group, you'd say, I observe all the necessary freedoms, it's free software. If you made the measurement among the users, you'd say, most of them don't have these freedoms, it's not free software. The developers of X did not consider that a problem, because they were not aiming to spread freedom. They were aiming for a big professional success. As far as they were concerned, those users using non-free versions of X were part of their success. But in the GNU project, our goal was to build a new world of freedom. And so if the same thing that happened to X were to happen to us, for us that would be total failure. So I look for a way to prevent this from happening. And the method I developed is called copyright, which I think in Portuguese is esquerdo aparal. The idea is that you take copyright and flip it over. Copyleft is implemented based on copyright law. Here's how it works. First, we put on a copyright notice, which informs people that the program is copyrighted, which by default means it's prohibited to copy and distribute it or modify it. But then we say, you are authorized to copy and distribute this. You are authorized to modify this. You are authorized to publish modified and extended versions. But there is a condition. And the condition is the reason why we go to all this trouble. The condition says that whenever you distribute any modified or extended version, any program that contains any substantial piece of this one, the whole of that program must be distributed under these same terms, no more and no less. Which means that that modified version must be free software also. We prohibit people from doing what those computer manufacturers did to X, stripping off the freedom and passing along non-free code, the program without the freedom. We insist that the freedom must accompany the code everywhere. No excuse is accepted for taking away the freedom. And thus, these freedoms I have explained to you, the freedoms that make something free software, become inalienable rights that all users have, because all users always should have these freedoms in using software. Using copyleft, we can bring that about for modified versions of our own code. The specific copyleft license that we use for most GNU programs is the GNU General Public License, or GNU GPL for short. It's actually used for more than two-thirds of all free software packages. It's a specific legal text that you can drop into your program, and then if you put the appropriate notices on every source file, then your program is copyleft. There are other copyleft licenses too. For instance, we have the GNU Lesser General Public License, which we use for some but not all libraries. And that is called lesser because it does less to defend everyone's freedom. But there are times when there is a strategic reason for making that compromise. We also have the GNU Free Documentation License, which was designed for manuals instead of for software, but actually is good for textbooks as well. And it was designed to entice commercial publishers to start using it. It has certain features designed to help them make a profit selling copies, even though everyone is free to copy the book. And there are, in fact, at least there's one commercial publisher who published a number of free books under the GNU Free Documentation License. And there's one who's published some free books under other licenses. So there is copylefted free software and there is non-copylefted free software. In both cases, the developers have respected your freedom. You have these freedoms that I explained before. The difference is, with copyleft, we go a step further and we actively defend your freedom from any middleman who would try to take it away from you. Whereas the developers of the non-copylefted free software don't do that. So they have not done anything wrong to you. But they haven't done as much positive things for freedom as they might have done. Despite that, their software does qualify as free, so we can use it. We can include it in a free operating system. And in fact, we have done that many times. The X Window system is one example. From the very beginning, I intended to put a Windows system into GNU. I had written a couple of Windows systems at MIT before that. But before we got around to actually writing a Windows system, we saw X. We saw that it was powerful, becoming a de facto standard. And it was free software. So I decided we won't write our own Windows system. We'll just use X. A big job saved, and that was very important. People pointed out often that the job of writing a whole free operating system was so big that they said we'd never finish it. Well, I thought we had a chance of finishing it, but clearly it was big, and we had to try to save work. Therefore, whenever somebody else wrote a free program that was suitable for the job, we used it. However, that only happened by accident, because those other people weren't aiming to make a free operating system. They had their own motives, whatever they were, but sometimes, for other reasons, they made a program free. So that happened occasionally. There were occasional pieces we didn't have to write. But other than that, we had a lot of pieces that were up to us. That was our work in the 80s. We had to develop those pieces or recruit someone else to develop them. In October 1985, we started the Free Software Foundation, which is a tax-exempt charity to promote free software. And in those years, a lot of what we did was hiring programmers and technical writers to develop pieces of GNU. The GNU C library was developed by FSF staff. The GNU shell, Bash, the command interpreter that users type at, those users who still type commands, was developed, but it's still an essential part of the system because there are lots of shell scripts running. Was also developed by an FSF staff person. The GNU C library is needed by every program that runs in user space. But most of the work was actually done by volunteers. In order to help guide them, in the mid to late 80s, we wrote the GNU task list. When it seemed that we had enough parts done, that it would be quicker to list what was missing than list what we had, we wrote a list of the pieces that were missing. That was the GNU task list. Initially, a list of the necessary system components that were missing, but now it's actually mostly a list of application programs that we would like. So, the volunteers have done the biggest part of the job. There are full-time volunteers and part-time volunteers. I'm a full-time volunteer because the FSF doesn't pay me. When the FSF first had enough money to hire one person, I, as president, had to decide who that should be. So I could either pay myself a salary or hire someone else. But it was my responsibility to spend the money effectively. And I realized that paying Stallman a salary would be throwing the money away, because we could get him to work for nothing. So I decided to hire someone else instead. There are other full-time volunteers as well. Mostly they're getting paid by somebody else, but for us, they're volunteers. There are also thousands of part-time volunteers who are not getting paid, who who work in their spare time. Why do they do this? There are people who like to pretend that people only have one motive, money. So they have a model of human nature which is extremely simple and completely ridiculous. Just look around in your life. So let me tell you some of the motives I've seen for developing free software. Of course, remember that one person can have multiple motives for a single act. One motive is political idealism, the desire to make the world a better place by for freedom. That's an important motive for me, but not my only one. And there are other people who contribute who don't share that motive. Another important motive is fun. Programming is tremendous fun. Not for everyone, but for a lot of the best programmers, and those are the people whose help we want most. It's especially fun if nobody's telling you what to do. This is why so many people who have jobs programming like to write free software in their spare time. Another important motive is to be appreciated. If your free program is used by 100,000 people, which is less than 1% of our community, that's a lot of appreciation you're going to get. Another similar but distinct motive is professional reputation. If your program is used by 100,000 people, you have a professional reputation right there. And you don't even need to go to school. People can have widely used free software packages by the time they graduate high school. I do recommend that you eventually go to college but there's no reason to study computer science, to study some other field and become more well-rounded. Another motive is gratitude. If you have been using the community software for years and really appreciating how good it is, then when you write a program, that's an opportunity to give something back to the community that is helping you. Another motive that I think is a bit shallow is hatred for Microsoft. There are a lot of people who hate Microsoft in particular. And because of that, they sometimes decide to do work to help us. Well, I think they're making a mistake focusing narrowly on Microsoft. Microsoft is a non-free software company, meaning it's attempting to keep the users divided and helpless. They're doing something wrong, but many other companies are doing the same wrong thing. Now, they haven't subjugated as many people as Microsoft has, but that's not for lack of trying. So really, they're no better. So it's a mistake to focus too much on Microsoft and on monopoly. Remember, a choice of non-free programs is just a choice of mass, which is not freedom. When people focus too much on Microsoft, that leads them down a path of thinking that monopoly is a problem, as if merely to have competition in non-free software made everything good. So they've misunderstood vaguely, but nonetheless, if they write free software for that reason, they are contributing to our community. Their contributions are useful, even if partially based on misunderstanding. And Microsoft is a danger to us. I won't underestimate that. It's just that we shouldn't misunderstand the problem by thinking that the problem is only Microsoft. The problem we are trying to solve is the problem of non-free software, and that's bigger than Microsoft. And of course, money is also a partial motive for those who have found jobs developing free software or providing support for free software. So there are many different motives for developing free software. And it's interesting to contrast this with the predictions that people used to make. They said, if the software is free, then no one will pay for it, so no one will compare it today with observed facts, we see that there are hundreds, at least, maybe thousands of people getting paid to work on free software. And there are over 500,000 volunteers. So our community is actually very large. We have so many developers that no software company could possibly match us. And yet people still wonder whether we can develop the broad range of software that's needed. That's like wondering whether airplanes can really fly. We already are developing the broad range of software that people need. So, by the early 90s, the GNU system was almost complete. We had almost all of these components except one. One important component was missing, the kernel. We started developing a kernel in 1990. I was waiting for a chance to take a shortcut, to thinking that this would get the system developed sooner. When you, after all, you can develop all these components in any order since you need them all. And then I found a chance to get a shortcut. We found a microkernel called Mach that had been developed at Carnegie Mellon as a funded project. And it wasn't free software, but it was going to be re-released as free software. So we started developing the top half of the kernel to run on top of Mach. The top half of the kernel is various servers that communicate through message passing, and together they do the whole job of the Unix kernel. And I thought that since half the job was done, and since the programs we would write would be user-based programs, we could debug them with a symbolic debugger easily, I thought that this way we would get things working reasonably quickly. It didn't happen for a number of reasons. In fact, it took years to get the GNU kernel to run. Fortunately, we did not have to wait for that. In 1991, Linus Torvalds, a Finnish college student, began developing a kernel, which he released under the name Linux. And in 92, he made it free software by putting it under the GNU General Public License. At that point, it was possible to make a complete free system by combining Linux and the incomplete GNU system, which had the rest. We didn't know about Linux. He never contacted us to tell us he had written a free kernel, although he had heard me give a speech in Helsinki. But he announced it to people somewhere, so other people took Linux and combined it with GNU, producing the GNU/Linux system. But they weren't aware that they were combining Linux and GNU, adding Linux to the GNU system, which was much larger than Linux at the time. Because they thought they were starting from Linux and looking around to find the other pieces that they needed. They looked around and lo and behold, everything they needed was already there. What good fortune, they said. But there was no luck about it. What they had found were old pieces of the GNU system, and they worked together because we were aiming to make a complete system, and we had been for some 8 years. So, while in fact they were making the GNU plus Linux system, they thought of it as making a Linux system. And that's how the confusion got started. That's how it happened that we were the principal developers of an operating system that's used by tens of millions of people, and most of them don't know we developed it. They think it was started by Linus Torvalds in 1991. The development of Linux was an important contribution to our community, because that was the step that carried us across the finish line. Before that, we had a collection of components that you could use on some other operating system, but you had to have another operating system first, and of course that was never free. After Linux was added, There was a complete system. You could install it in a bare PC. You could actually get a modern computer and run it with free software. So the goal we had set out for explicitly in 1983 had been reached. But the mistake of calling the entire system Linux was a terrible blow to the free software movement, because it broke the connection from our software to our philosophy. Before that time, people who used some pieces of GNU on another system knew that they were using pieces of GNU. They thought of themselves as GNU users, and so when they read the articles that described our philosophy, the same philosophy I'm telling you about today, they would think about it carefully. This didn't mean they would always agree, but thinking about it seriously meant there was a good chance they would agree. And if they did agree, they would then feel motivated to help develop more GNU. So the software spread the philosophy, and the philosophy helped expand the software. But when people started using basically the entire GNU system, but thinking of it as Linux, they were no longer led to our philosophy. Instead, they were led to the philosophy associated with the name Linux, which is the amoral, apolitical philosophy of Linus Torvalds. Linus Torvalds doesn't agree with most of what I told you today. He doesn't believe that, ethically speaking, users should have the freedom to share and change software. In fact, he develops non-free software in his job and said so to thousands of people. Now, he has a right to his views, but we think that our work should be associated with the views that motivated us to do it. The user should know that the system they're using is the result of a many-year sustained campaign for freedom. To have fun is a perfectly good motive for developing free software. To learn is a good motive. Those were Linus Torvalds' motives, he says. And there's nothing to criticize in those motives, but those motives alone would never have got people to make the sustained effort that we made with the target of a completely free operating system. That required political idealism as well. Nowadays, most of the users are not aware of this because they're never told this. And the result is the most ironic things that they say. They talk about the system as if it were merely an economic question or an alternative to Windows. And they say things like, when they do see our philosophy, they say, why does this matter to me? I'm a Linux user. Now, if they knew that they were using the GNU/Linux system, they might see why it should matter to them, because they know there's GNU users. And it gets even worse. Sometimes they say that this focus on freedom is a mistake because it interferes with the success of Linux. If only they knew. Okay. Examination from the proprietary software world. Proprietary software developers measure their success by the number of users for a logical reason. They figure every user has to pay them, so more users means more money. It's evil, but it's rational. But when applied to free software, it's not rational. Why, after all, should we be emotionally attached to the number of users of a particular kernel? That kernel works, it's free software, a lot of us use it. It does its job and it's perfectly fine if more people use it, but that's not the overall purpose of things. That's not what's really important. Of course, some of them think that Linux means the entire GNU/Linux system, so they want more people to use the system. But why should we be emotionally attached to the number of users of one particular free operating system? It does its job, it's good if more people use it. You could forgive me, perhaps, for being emotionally attached to it since I started it, but even I realize that the popularity of the system is not what's important overall. What's important is freedom. Freedom to cooperate and treat each other decently. Sometimes when people who think of themselves as Linux users see our philosophy, they say, this is so idealistic it must be impractical. If only they knew that the system they love is the practical fruit of this philosophy, they could still disagree with it if they want, but they would have trouble calling it impractical. Because in truth, there's nothing as practical as idealism. If you're trying to do a very big job, and you don't have billions of dollars, you must have idealism, because only that is going to keep you going in the right direction until you get there. There's nothing more important for our community than to remember the importance of freedom, and that freedom is the reason for all this. If we forget the goal, we won't end up there. We'll drift away and end up somewhere else. And you can already see that happening. There's a tendency for various distributors of the GNU/Linux system to put non-free programs into it and say that it's an improvement. So there's nothing more important than remembering the goal of freedom. And this is why I ask people to please stop calling the system Linux. Linux is the name of one component, the kernel. The system as a whole is GNU/Linux or GNU+Linux. Sometimes people give me what they think is helpful and wise advice that I shouldn't ask for this. They say, it doesn't look good to ask for credit. And that's true. So they say, I should stop saying this. And that when people call the system Linux, I should smile to myself and take pride in a job well done. This would be wise advice if the assumption were true, the assumption that the job is done. We've made a great beginning, but we have come nowhere near finishing the job. Consider, we've developed a free operating system that's used by tens of millions of people. But there are hundreds of millions of computers. Only a few percent are using the GNU/Linux system. So we've made a great start, but we have a long way to go. And we've developed in our community two free operating systems, two free graphical desktops, two free office suites, and a number of applications. But there are many more applications we need to reach the situation where you can do anything you can do with a computer, you can do with free software. Because that should be the ultimate goal. The first goal had to be a free operating system, because an operating system is the first thing you need in order to use your computer at all. It won't run without an operating system. But the ultimate goal is that everyone who wants to do things with a computer should be able to do it with free software. People should never feel that they choose between doing a necessary job on a computer and keeping their freedom. So we have a lot more work to do. The job is not done. And now we have something that we never had before. We have enemies. Large, rich companies actively trying to stop us from achieving this goal. Companies such as Microsoft, Disney, the record companies, all pushing in various ways to stop us from developing free software for some goals. And there are laws in the US and to some extent in Europe that prohibit development of free software for certain important jobs. In the US, there are two such laws. One is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has been interpreted to prohibit free software for reading encrypted media, such as, for instance, DVDs. The format of DVDs was secret. Then a few programmers in Europe figured out the format and released a free software package called DECSS and released it under the GNU GPL. So it was possible to take a DVD that you had bought and put it into your computer's DVD reader and watch the movie using entirely free software. But that program has been banned in the US. It is censored. Because they say you could use it for copying. And if you could use it for copying, then it's likely to be prohibited unless it has another important commercial use. Other use in people's homes doesn't count because things that aren't commercial have no rights. What you see there is neoliberalism at work. A Russian programmer who had written a program that would convert encrypted ebooks to a public standard format was arrested and threatened with imprisonment when he visited the US. It's an interesting reversal. It used to be that Americans were sometimes arrested and imprisoned for unjust reasons when they visited Russia. Now it's the US that people have to be scared to visit. Even more now, where Bush puts people in prison without charges and threatens to hold them in prison forever, which is essentially not what you can find in a free country. So I'm sad to say that Europe has adopted a directive with similar requirements. And right now, the countries of Europe are deciding how to implement this requirement. It could be implemented in a way that allows free software, which does only lawful jobs. But it could also be implemented in a way like the US, or even worse. In France, they are proposing to prohibit even publishing information about how those systems work. All that information would be suppressed. Research on those fields would be impossible. But what are human rights compared with Hollywood? Now, the other law that in the US prohibits many different kinds of free software is patent law. Because in the US, ideas used in software can be patented. This is not a matter of patenting programs. People who think that have misunderstood the issue. If it were a question of patenting a single program, it wouldn't be a big deal. Instead, though, patents cover ideas. And as you know, a single program uses many different ideas. If you look at a word processor, you'll see hundreds of features. Each feature is at least one idea, and could be patented in various different ways at the same time. So there could potentially be hundreds of patents covering the one word processor, covering parts of it. In practice, it's not likely that all of them are patented, but there could well be many patents. Which means that developing a modern program means running the risk of a patent lawsuit. It's like crossing a minefield, because in each decision, there's only a small chance you will step on a patent. But there are many decisions you have to take, so there's a real danger that at some point you'll step on a patent, which will slow and destroy your project. A good way to explain this to non-programmers is to make an analogy between programs and symphonies. Because a symphony uses many musical ideas. It has to combine them. Of course, you can't just put them in. You have to write notes to embody them and make the notes fit together as well. But still, those notes in a good symphony embody many musical ideas. So imagine if the governments of Europe in the 1700s had decided they would promote the progress of symphonic music with a system of musical idea patents. Any musical idea that could be described in words could be patented. And then, oh, and by the way, in the US, I suppose, probably a musical idea could be patented. Who knows? But suppose this had been true in the 1700s. So then by 1800, there would have been thousands of musical idea patents. So now imagine that you're Beethoven and you want to write a symphony and not get sued. You would find it's harder to write a symphony and not get sued than to write a symphony that sounds good. Being Beethoven, you would complain about this. And the patent holders would say, oh, Beethoven, you're just jealous because we thought of those ideas before you. Why not go think of your own ideas instead of ripping us off? Now, as it happens, in fact, Beethoven had a lot of new ideas as composers go, but he had to combine them with lots of old ideas in order to make recognizable music. No one is such a genius that he can reinvent music from zero and make something people will listen to. Pierre Boulez said he would reinvent the language of music from zero, and he tried, but not many people listened to it. It's the same with software. Nobody is so brilliant he can reinvent all the software from zero and make something that's of any use. Certainly not, and produce a whole spectrum of software that works. So software patents are actually an obstacle to all software developers and even to software users, because the users can get sued also. Europe is right now considering a directive on software patents, and it's essential for Europeans to convince the European Parliament to vote against software patents. The directive that was written by the Business Software Alliance and proposed by the European Commission has vague words in it. They say that these words will mean no software patents, but we are sure that the words will be stretched to allow software patents. Therefore, we have proposed amendments to prohibit software patents, and we have to, and some committees have adopted these. We therefore are asking the members of the European Parliament to vote for that version of the directive. It's up to you to get this to happen. It's necessary to convince the conservative members of Parliament, because most of the ones on the left will be voting against software patents, but the conservatives are likely to vote for it. They've been told by the big companies that software patents are good for software developers and that this is the way for Europe to compete with the US. Both of them are based on complete misunderstanding of how software patents actually function. I recommend it for more information. You read www.software-patents.org. And for really complete information, there's a site that's dense. political lobbying in Europe. Please devote your efforts to this now. There are maybe just a couple of months before the parliament votes. And it will make a tremendous difference to the future of all software in Europe, whether people are allowed to develop software freely. There is a further threat, which is more subtle, because it's not a law. It's a change in hardware. The plan is to change all computers so that they won't obey their users anymore. The developers of this call it trusted computing. But that name is a lie, because actually it means that software companies can trust your computer to disobey you. So we call it treacherous computing. The idea is to enable any application to save data in a sealed format, an encrypted format, such that other programs can't possibly access it. Now, this has two purposes. Of course, it would be used for published data, things equivalent to DVDs. That way, it would be an obstacle to making free software that can play the DVD. But they plan to do it with your data also. An application can save your data in a format that other programs can't access. For instance, imagine if a new version of Microsoft Word 5 years from now were made to use a format that used treacherous computing to lock it up. Then no program could ever read Word files without authorization from Microsoft. Right now, it's difficult to figure out Word format. People in our community have figured out some aspects of it, so there are free programs that can read some Word files, but not all. But if they use treacherous computing to lock them up, you could never read them. By the way, Microsoft is also planning to use software hacks to prevent us from reading Word files. They have they're proposing an extended version of XML, which they patented. And then we think that'll be the next Word format, and thus they'll be able to sue anybody who makes programs that can handle Word format. So I said that we shouldn't think of Microsoft as the whole of the problem, but Microsoft is an important part of the active opposition to our campaign for freedom. And one thing that weakens our community is the existence of another movement in our community, one that doesn't talk about the goal of freedom. It was formed specifically not to talk about this goal. It's called the Open Source Movement. In the early 90s, free software got a reputation for being powerful and reliable, and thus millions of people started to use it for its practical benefits alone. This was both good and bad. It was good because more users also meant more developers, which meant we got more free software doing more things, and also making it more powerful and reliable, which is useful. But the bad thing was that those people who didn't think about freedom didn't tell other people that freedom was the goal. They just said to people, oh, here's, look at this powerful, reliable software you can use, and you can get it cheap. So we got millions of people in our community who never heard about the goal of freedom. We are not just beginning to drift off the road. We are almost in the ditch. We have to work very hard now to talk about freedom more. But in 1998, some of those people formed the Open Source Movement. And they recommend the same practices that we say are an ethical imperative. But they don't say these practices are an ethical imperative. They just recommend them for practical reasons. They go to companies and say, we think you'd actually do better software room and say, we won't give up our freedom by using your program. We're going to liberate our community from you. Completely different philosophical values are being cited here. So you can choose your political views. You could support the free software movement and the ideas I've been telling you. You could support the open source movement. You could reject them both. You could have ideas somewhere around them in between. There are many different views that you could come up with. And it's up to you. But I'd like to ask for your support for the free software movement. And one way you can express your support is by saying free software or software leader. Because if you say the word free, you are giving support to our movement. If you say open source, you're giving support to the other movement. And the easiest first way to support us is by waving our banner. Now you'll probably notice that lots of journalists, corporations, and politicians say open source. That's because they're trying to stay away from the ideal of freedom. They find freedom an embarrassment. Now you think that that governments that are democratic ought to be championing the ideal of freedom. I guess it's that they're not really that democratic. Governments that were concerned about the general public wouldn't adopt laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or the EU Copyright Directive. Those result from government of the people by the companies for the corporations. So, simply by talking about free software and talking about GNU/Linux, you can help keep the awareness of freedom as a goal alive in our community. People will not defend their freedom unless they first value their freedom, and for that, they have to know what the freedom is. So it's up to you to tell them. The open source people develop free software, some of them, but they don't tell people what the issue of freedom is. That's up to us. So now I will end the talk by mentioning, well, first I should mention the website for more information. In general, it's www.gnu.org. You can find out about FSF Europe by looking at fsfeurope.org. I have with me some cards that you can use to become an associate member of the FSF. So come and ask me for one if you want to do that. The dues are substantial. This is a fundraising method. We also have some stickers that we're happy to give out, and various giveaway handouts that you can take. And I have just two copies with me of this book of essays, Free Software, Free Society. And I'm going to be selling them on behalf of the FSF for €40. So people have sometimes complained to me, oh, one other thing. Is there a piece of paper we could use for people to put their names and addresses down on in case they want to help? Yes, we'll have a couple of pieces of paper and put them up here so that people can use them for that. So people have sometimes accused me of having a holier-than-thou attitude. And they're right. I am holy. I'm a saint. So it's my job to be holy. So let me now present to you my alter ego. computer by child. Emacs started out as a text editor, but then became a way of life for one users, and ultimately a revision. We even have a great schism between two rival versions of Emacs. And now we have Saints. Fortunately, no gods, to be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has some advantages compared with certain other churches I might name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So if you are looking for a church to be holy in, you might consider ours. But it does require making a moral commitment to live a life of purity. You must exorcise any evil proprietary operating systems possessing any of the computers under your direct factual control, and then install a wholly free operating system. Holy being spelled in two different ways. And then only install free software on top of that. If you make that commitment and live by it, then you too will be a saint, and you may eventually have a halo, if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. Now, sometimes people ask me if in the Church of Emacs it is a sin to use VR. The answer is that using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. And people sometimes ask me if my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. So, now I guess it's time for questions. Do we need people to speak into a microphone for the questions? Because there are people in another room. So where's the microphone for them? Is there a microphone for them?
Well, that's something else. Just a second.
Sì, alguien quiser colocar questo en portugués, pueden hacer y intentaremos traducir.
The actual lawsuit, by the way, is SCO versus IBM. And it's a contract dispute. SCO is claiming that IBM used some materials and put them into, whether it's Linux or GNU/Linux, we don't know, in violation of a contract. Now, I have no idea what that contract said, and I don't know what IBM did. What I can say is, when they contributed to GNU programs, we asked the maintainers to check, to have them say that they had the right to do this. When they contributed to FSF copyrighted programs, we asked them to sign an affirmation that they held the copyright and that they were entitled to do this. Now, you know, when you have 500,000 developers, there's always a chance somebody is going to plagiarize. But, so in fact, if we find out that that happens, we don't use his work.
No, the second question is, what is exactly the mechanism for preventing big companies like Microsoft to do the opposite, that is stealing free software and integrating them into their program?
Well, there's no mechanism. However, when you're talking about GPL-covered programs, what we find is that when the FSF complains to somebody, he generally stops. We have never had to go so far as to go to court. And in general, we find that the larger the company is, the less they are willing to take the risk of violating the GPL.
Is there a real risk of being found doing that?
Often they're found. And employees who are disgruntled can tell us. Now, we have no way of knowing how many cases were not found. But as we spread awareness of the GPL, companies become less likely to want to take the risk. After all, it is a crime.
It's not difficult to find problems with patent law, patents in software, or with stolen name and copyright act. However, to what extent would you advocate either reform or removal of all intellectual property protection?
I think, first of all, don't use the term protection, that's a propaganda word. It's trying to get people to assume unconsciously that programs or songs or ideas would be destroyed, damaged, ruined if people could copy them and listen to them or read them or run them more. And that's complete nonsense. So don't use that word. The next thing is don't use the term intellectual property, because that's inviting people to assume that this is one issue and that it's the same issue as physical object property rights. And both of them are unstable. The second one is a matter of bias. They want you to assume that the right way to deal with the issue of copying programs or the issue of using ideas is to think of those things as property. That's a rather strange idea, but they want you to take for granted that that's what has to be done, to fail to consider alternatives. So that's a way of prejudicing all consideration of the issue, of the issues. Well, the other thing is that copyrights and patents are completely different issues. And if you want to think clearly about them, the first step is never mix them up. Never generalize about them. The public policy issues that they raise are different. The only thing they have in common is a very narrow economic argument that could be made for them, an argument that's dubious, by the way. The simplistic argument of if people aren't forced to pay for permission to use it, no one will do it. And we know that's not true. I do not try to consider copyright and patents together. I have different views about them. And no, I don't advocate the total abolition of either one. It would take a long time to explain my views on either one. There's no time for that. By the way, quote, intellectual property, unquote, also includes trademarks, which are basically a good thing. So, anybody who expresses an opinion about, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is most surely saying something foolish, because it's an overgeneralization, it's simplistic. You want to have an intelligent opinion about copyrights or an intelligent opinion about patents. Don't mix them up with anything else.
I can tell from your answer that, as you said, there is scope for some of what is called.
I don't know enough about most fields of engineering to have an opinion about patents in those fields.
Okay.
Can I use now? From you?
Okay. Sure.
What is your opinion about new operating systems on Apple?
The app. Wait, you're talking about MacOS?
Yes, MacOS 10.
MacOS because is not free software.
No. Okay. That's it?
That's it.
and the kernel. And the kernel itself is
well,
sure and the
I don't know about the kernel. However, what I can tell you is that the software that Apple developed and released the source for is released at present under a license which qualifies as open source but does not qualify as free software. And it doesn't include the interesting parts of the system anyway. It's programmed to do jobs we already have programs to do. So So even if that were free software, it would be the right thing to do for those programs, but it wouldn't be any real contribution to our community. The interesting parts of macOS are not released under that license. Their source code is not released at all.
Setting up a manufacturing operation, which has nothing to do with this.
manufacturers are allowed to do. That's industrial regulations.
I
IBM right now has the new buzzword that they call open news standards. What is the position of FSF about it?
Well, of course people should be free to implement standards. I'm not completely sure what IBM means by open standards. But yes, we are raising political issues on in a number of fronts about being free to implement standards. That's one of the dangers of software patents, is that they prohibit people from implementing standards freely, or prohibit them from implementing standards in free software. What time is it?
I guess we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Where's the mic?
Okay.
A small question. You told us about your choice of Unix. Back when you started, the OS landscape was much more, you had more of a wide choice. Nowadays, you practically only see itself in Windows and Unix.
And MacOS, but now
MacOS is becoming. Also, how do you feel about that? You say, wow, did I make a great choice? Or do you say,
remember that Windows did not exist. Microsoft Windows did not exist in 1983 when I made that decision. So I think I made the right decision. Anyway, Windows initially was designed as a single-user system. We were developing from the beginning a multi-user file sharing system, which is part of the reason why it has better security, for instance.
Para que nos pierdan su servicio. Obrigado e vamos agradecer a Richard Thomas por aqui.